From Masonic Temple in Detroit, NBC brings you the address of Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg, Senior Senator of Michigan, to the Lincoln Day dinner of the Wayne County Republican Committee. Senator Vandenberg's subject will be the Republican Challenge. Senator Vandenberg.
Now, ladies. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor to present to this distinguished gathering the senior senator from the state of Michigan, the Honorable Arthur H. Vandenberg.
Mr. Chairman, fellow Americans, tonight we remember Abraham Lincoln, the immortal founder of our Republican faith. We rededicate ourselves to his country, his party, and the common welfare for which he died. In his spirit, we sustain liberty and equality under law, which makes the American way of life the most precious heritage on earth. Our pledge is to destiny American style. I waste no time on recent accidents. Our need is to work in the vineyard and not to sob at the wailing wall. Suffice it to note in November retrospect that our Democratic friends, as bewildered as we, found themselves fulfilling St. Mark's prophecy, the stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. Meanwhile, in our own stunned but highly vocal melancholy, we find ourselves sustained by the promise in the Psalms that the meek shall inherit the earth. I hope we also recall that heaven helps those who help themselves. There is a job to be done, and we must do it. Now, I want to present my compliments tonight to the distinguished governor of New York from his home state of his home birth. I want also to present my compliments to the unpredictable gentleman from Missouri, the most famous one-man tornado in the history of political hurricanes. And as president of our United States, I wish him luck. But here is a significant fact, my friends. This same president who spent 6 soapbox months telling the American people how the Republicans had ruined them opened his first address to Congress with a complete confession to the contrary. His first official sentence was, "I am happy to report that the State of the Union is good." Now, what do you think of that? When I recall how bad he said we were at every whistle stop on the map, my consolation is Lincoln's assurance that you can't fool them all the time. The State of the Union is relatively good, but it could slide to pretty bad if the administration should really try to do all the new things and raise all the new taxes necessary to meet all the new expenditures and to mobilize all the new bureaucrats required by all the new promises made in the recent Democratic blitz. You couldn't possibly pay for the recent Democratic national platform with a budget of less than $60 billion a year, and you couldn't run that kind of a country except with all your economic freedoms in a perpetual straitjacket. Of course, they won't try to keep all of these promises, but they'll try just enough of them to make this country thankful that an alerted Republican Party continues to be full of health and vigor. that's where our job begins. The Republican Party must prove by its works that it knows what it takes to preserve the American way of life, what it takes to serve the common welfare and save it from special privilege, what it takes to answer human needs without sacrificing human liberty, what it takes to preserve solvent mass prosperity, to restore public thrift to a place of respectability, to conserve both the family budget and the public treasury, what it takes to avoid forever the police state or the welfare state in which man becomes the servant and not the master of his government, what it takes to sustain our blessings and to deserve the public trust. There stands the challenge. But we can only meet it, my friends, by proving to young America that here is the party which preserves its precious inheritance, and by proving to the veterans of two world wars that here is the party which conserves the things for which they fought. These are the facts. It is our job to make them thrive. Now, the Republican Party largely built the foundations upon which this nation has erected the most fabulous economy of all time. 6% of the Earth's population controlling at least 40% of the world's income. The Republican Party largely built the foundations of this free competitive economy, which has produced incomparably the highest wage and living standards anywhere on Earth for the uncommon man who calls himself American. The name of Lincoln certifies that the Republican Party was born to protect human rights for all without discrimination, and the areas under its normal political control are where these boons best flourish. The name of Lincoln also certifies that it is the party of the Constitution, and I am not conscious that it has ever wavered. It is our task to put history in gear with the unfolding requirements of our time and to make Republican achievement for mass America repeat itself. Now, an inevitable question immediately intrudes. Should Republicanism be a liberal or a conservative party? That's what I want to talk about for a few minutes. Frankly, I do not believe there can usefully be any such identification, because if you try it, you will find yourself impaled on the horns of rival definitions. Let's see. What is a conservative? At one point, the dictionary says, quote, one who seeks to prevent loss, decay, or injury, and who protects and preserves. In that sense, I want my party to be conservative. In that sense, we serve our country when we are conservative. I want my party in this sense to respond to the deepest instincts of our republic. But at another point, the dictionary says a conservative is, quote, one who is opposed to change or progress. In that sense, I do not want my party to be conservative. If it is, it is static and it will die. This is not a static country or a static age. For example, there was nothing static in the vision of those Detroit motor pioneers who dared to think in terms of radical change when they created the techniques of mass production. Yet they were the greatest conservers of their time. They operated within free enterprise. They enriched the American way of life. Conservatives, in the right sense, are not at war with progress. They are its most vivid allies. What is a liberal? A liberal may be an earnest soul, unimpeachable in his fidelity to the roots and anchors of the American system, who wants the maximum measure of life, liberty, and happiness for our total people. In that sense, I want my party to be liberal. On the other hand, this so-called liberal may seek the substitution of socialism for free enterprise and paternalism for individual responsibility. In that sense, I do not want my party to be liberal. I am not interested in equality of servitude. Going still farther, this liberalism may be a shoddy cloak for communism dedicated to the violent overthrow of our free institutions and to the degradation of free souls. In that sense, I not only do not want my party to be liberal, I want it to be relentlessly hostile, vigilantly militant, and uncompromising, even with red herring. Where does this leave us? I answer for myself. I want the Republican Party to be the common denominator of sound conservatism and sound liberalism. I want it to travel down the high center road, and I think I can prove that that is its assignment. Let me borrow Lincoln's familiar analogy. When asked once how long a man's legs should be, he replied, long enough to reach the ground. I want the Republican Party to be conservative enough to save every time-tried fundamental upon which the unique and precious character of Americanism depends, ever faithful to the admonition of the prophet Isaiah, look ye to the rock, whence ye are hewn. But within these landmarks, I want the Republican Party to be liberal enough to march with the times, to dare new answers to new problems, and to use the power and strength and initiative of government to help citizens to help themselves when they confront problems beyond their own resources and their own control. I want the oak to stand, but I want the branches to grow. What the hell are you doing? Let me give you three illustrations, because these are just words up to date. Let me illustrate. The private banking system of this country was shattered in the early 30s. Needlessly shattered, in my view, but shattered nonetheless. Banking confidence struck zero. Today, banking confidence is complete and impregnable. Why? At least one of the overriding reasons is that federal bank deposit insurance intervened and at substantial Republican insistence. Now, this is the point. It was a new device. It was so liberal when proposed by Republicans that even President Roosevelt at first bluntly sought its rejection. Yet it was conservative because it conserved private enterprise in banking, and no legislator has ever been bold enough to propose its repeal. It was a bridge upon which the nation strode to safety. I want the Republican Party to be the conservative builder of such liberal bridges when necessity requires. Now let me illustrate again. There is a vast propaganda today for socialized medicine. I think it would destroy precious personal relationships in the American way of life. That it would produce wholesale mediocrity in the skills which serve the sick and saddle us with a new and appalling bureaucracy. But this does not require me to blind my eyes to the existence of a crushing and well-nigh universal sick problem in the lives of millions of our citizens. It is a problem that must be met. But we have a choice of methods. One is voluntary and therefore typically American. The other is involuntary and therefore typically bureaucratic. The latter is socialized medicine. The former is cooperative medicine. I expect the American people and the Republican Party to choose the former. I want my party to look at the great humanitarian cooperative efforts of the Blue Cross, for example, which represents cooperation and not compulsion. It comes to finest fruition here in Michigan, where one out of four of our people already thus have cheaper and better protection than they would ever get from socialized medicine. Probably two out of four of our Michigan people are covered by this or other voluntary plans. I expect the Republican Party to offer cooperative legislation to encourage these voluntary plans within the states. Thus, it will liberally conserve the public welfare in the best American tradition. Thus, it will build another bridge. Now, another example. Certainly, a better bridge is necessary between capital and labor. For either to harm the other is suicide. Take-home pay is of vital concern to millions of workers. Take-home dividends are just as vital to other millions whose savings and investments built the factories, bought the tools, and hired the know-how without which labor would walk the streets. It is equally true that the factories without workers would be futile brick and mortar. The point is, united they stand, divided they fall. I do not want the Republican Party to be the exclusive partisan of either. I do not want it to be left or right. I want it to earn the fair play confidence of both. I want it to be the bridge. Only thus can it serve the public interest, which is paramount to both. On July 30th, 1945, I wrote the Secretary of Labor suggesting a top-level labor management conference to hunt this middle ground. The President approved. The call was signed by top leaders in labor and business. For various reasons, the conference failed, but that is beside the point. The point is that here was formal recognition by all concerned of this common interest which I stress tonight. I hope this common interest will be the Republican Party's goal. Neither big business, nor big labor, nor big government should be the Republican Party's special client in writing or rewriting these laws. The total welfare of all labor's rank and file, the total welfare of all private enterprise, and the total public interest in industrial peace and equity under law and order, these are the constituents who should be confident of our equal and impartial consideration. The united welfare of the whole labor-management relationship is more important to both than the special interest of either. I want the Republican Party to be conservative enough and liberal enough to build this bridge. Now, Mr. Chairman, my radio time is pressing, and I must turn briefly to foreign affairs. We have won two wars, but there is no peace. The basic reason is clear. The Politburo in Moscow has refused it to us and to other independent peoples everywhere. Instead, we face aggressions. We face violent libels against our own democracy. We confront a communist conspiracy of conquest against free governments, free men, and free souls. Among other things, the mistakes of Yalta and Potsdam thus come home to roost. Our own national security is inseparably involved. In such a cause, there can be neither appeasement nor surrender. It should not be necessary, my friends, to speak in these terms. This Cold War could end in 20 minutes. Soviet Russia being willing in deeds as well as words. We ask nothing of her except the right of independent nations to live and let live according to their own free choice in their own domains. We poise no threat to Russia's free exercise of this authority for herself. We have even offered to guarantee her against Axis resurgence for 50 years. Let our attitude be plain, particularly to the Russian people, who surely must crave peace as much as we. We offer friendship on a two-way street. We will scrupulously observe every obligation we have taken in the Atlantic Charter and under the United Nations. We want no territories. We seek no reparations. We will join in universal disarmament, including atomic bombs, under dependable disciplines against bad faith. In other words, despair of honorable peace shall never be chargeable to us. But, my friends, we can take nothing for granted. We have learned some painful lessons, which we dare not ignore. Where deceit is taught as a diplomatic virtue, one must watch for booby traps and ambush. Only actions speak dependably. Pending the precious day of voluntary peace, we shall look to our own national security and we shall keep our powder dry. We shall support collective security and justice through a United Nations which we shall strengthen in every possible way in the spirit of its universal hope. We shall join other congenial nations in regional security arrangements inside the United Nations Charter, but outside the Soviet veto. Within the limit of our means, we shall continue existing plans to help other free peoples, to help themselves, to rise again and stand on their own feet. We shall be relentless against subversive communist treachery wherever it rears its ugly head. And when I say we, I am speaking of the predominant Republican record. Now, during the last 2 years, when the presidency and Congress represented different parties, America could only speak with unity, and therefore with power, through some instrument of liaison. So-called bipartisan foreign policy provided the connecting link. It did not apply to everything, for example, not to Palestine or China. But it did apply generally elsewhere. It helped to formulate foreign policy before it ever reached the legislative stage. Otherwise, it would not have worked. Let's be clear about that. It was not a carbon copy process. There are outstanding Republican trademarks in every act that Congress passed. It was a meeting of minds. Thus, we achieved substantial unity. Our government did not splinter. It did not default. It was strong in the presence of its adversaries. Without this liaison during those 2 years, I should hate to think where we in the world would be today. I shall be forever proud of the notable Republican contribution to this end. We demonstrated our dependability. I shall be forever proud that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, upon 47 key occasions, found common ground, unanimously voted 13-0, and presented a united front to this distraught world. In this regard, the 80th Republican Congress was the best in history, the president of this country to the contrary notwithstanding. Some say that the change means that the spirit of bipartisan foreign policy is dead. Some say that certain recent unfortunate events, like the stupid Democratic raid upon Republican representation on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, have pronounced its obituary. That is not my view. The form of things, to be sure, has changed, and responsibilities and initiatives have shifted because both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue are now in Democratic control. But the basic need remains. We are called upon to hold the government and the administration as Republicans in the loyal opposition. We are called upon to hold them to strict accountability, to be sure that we do not overpromise our own resources or overpromise others who are thus misled in depending upon us. But in the final analysis, the basic need, I repeat, for unity remains. It will be a sad hour for the Republic if we ever desert the fundamental concept that partisan politics should stop at the water's edge. It will be a triumphant day for those who would divide and conquer us if we abandon the quest for a united voice when America demands peace with honor in the world. In my view, nothing has happened to absolve either Democrats or Republicans from continuing to put their country first. And those who don't will neither serve their country or their party or themselves. Mr. Chairman, the limitations on my time have forced me to a very sketchy presentation of only a few of the problems critically confronting our American judgments. I should like to leave with you, in closing, I should like to leave with you the overall impression that I am proud to stand here tonight as a Republican. We are called to as great responsibilities as we have ever faced. We are needed by the nation. Through tolerant consultation, we shall weld our own victorious unity into great and vital public service and into popular confidence and trust. I hear 1950 calling. I intend that republicanism shall justify its response. May the Lincoln spirit be our impulse and our benediction. I thank you very much for your support.
Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg, senior Republican of Michigan, has just addressed the Lincoln Day dinner of the Wayne County Republican Committee on the subject, the Republican Challenge. This program came from Detroit through the facilities of WWJ. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.
The Seal Test Variety Theater and Falstaff's Music from the Heart of America, usually heard in the preceding period on many of these stations, were not heard tonight in order that we might bring you an address by Senator Arthur Vandenberg. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.